You know, I think there's a coffin up there.
I'm going to vacuum around and museum.
There's some Episcopal rector somewhere in this country who, younger than I am, built his own coffin and as it's standing around, puts his wine bottles in. He wants to get used to living with it. If you will remember, we left the bishop yesterday afternoon. Gretchen, are you going to be the bishop again?
Sure.
We were, I think, about in the middle of page 43.
There's something about stagnation here.
Yeah, the issue was whether or not there is such a thing as absolute truth. And I know Paul is just sitting there waiting to pounce on C.S. Lewis at this point. And
I'm glad I'm going to pounce on him instead of some other person.
At any rate, he starts on page 42. He starts, the bright spirit starts by trying to get the bishop to believe in heaven. And the bishop replies, I'm not sure the exact point you're trying to make. And the ghost says, this bright spirit says, I'm not trying to make any point at all. I'm just telling you to repent and believe. To which the bishop replies, my dear boy, I believe already we may not be perfectly agreed, but you have misjudged me completely if you do not realize my religion is very real and a very precious thing to me. And then the sprite spirit changes his plan. And let's pick it up there, Gretchen. Bottom of 42. Very well. Will you believe in me?
In what sense?
Will you come with me to the mountains? It will hurt at first until your feet are hardened. Reality is harsh to the feet of shadows. But will you come?
Well, that is a plan. I am perfectly ready to consider it. Of course, I should require some assurances. I should want to guarantee that you are taking me to a place where I shall find a wider sphere of usefulness and scope for the talents that God has given me, and an atmosphere of free inquiry. In short, all that one needs by civilization and the spiritual life.
No, I can promise you none of these things. No sphere of usefulness, you are not needed there at all. No scope for your talents, only forgiveness for having perverted them. Can I just interject? How many of you were in Jody Kretzmann's session this morning? He talked about Jesus, the friend who is completely useless. Not utilitarian at all. And in one sense, I was reminded this morning, and again by this line of a presentation by, or a lecture by one of my teachers at Heidelberg, who said that the ministry, he was talking about the fact that pastors often feel that they are useless, and he said, that's right, they are. And he said, the whole Christian ministry, in a sense, stands as a sign of the end of this world, because it is in fact a useless profession. It is economically useless. It produces nothing. It services nothing. It stands as a sign of uselessness in the world. Phew, that's very hard for clergy. But at any rate, here he is, that's, yeah, help people, but that's not quite the point. The point is that it is not economically useful. It's not psychologically useful, like psychiatry. It's not educationally useful. It is not, certainly not manufacturingly useful. It's in one sense really a useless thing. Well, that's what he's saying will happen to you in heaven. No sphere of usefulness. You are not needed there at all. No scope for your talents. Only forgiveness for having perverted them. No atmosphere of inquiry, for I will bring you to the land not of questions but of answers, and you shall see the face of God.
Ah, but we must all interpret those beautiful words in our own way. For me, there is no such thing as a final answer. The free wind of inquiry must always continue to blow through the mind, must it not? Prove all things. To travel hopefully is better than to arrive.
If that were true, and known to be true, How could anyone travel hopefully? There would be nothing to hope for.
But you must feel yourself that there is something stifling about the idea of finality. Stagnation, my dear boy, what is more soul-destroying than stagnation?
You think that because hitherto you have experienced truth only with the abstract intellect. I will bring you where you can taste it like honey and be embraced by it as by a bridegroom. Your thirst shall be quenched.
Well, really, no, I am not aware of a thirst for some ready-made truth which puts an end to intellectual activity in the way you seem to be describing. Will it leave me the free play of mind, Dick? I must insist on that, you know.
Free as a man is free to drink while he is drinking, he is not free still to be dry. I can make... Oh, you have to say that.
No. I can make nothing of that idea.
Listen. Once you were a child, once you knew what inquiry was for, there was a time when you asked questions because you wanted answers and were glad when you had found them. Become that child again, even now.
Ah, but when I became a man, I put away childish things.
You have gone far wrong. Thirst was made for water. This is one of Lewis's whole characteristic themes, that every appetite, in a sense, was made to be filled, and the desire for God is one of the ways Lewis says indicates there must be God to satisfy it. Thirst was made for water, inquiry for truth. What you now call the free play of inquiry has neither more nor less to do with the ends for which intelligence was given you than masturbation has to do with marriage.
If we cannot be reverent, there is at least no need to be obscene. The suggestion that I should return at my age to the mere factual inquisitiveness of boyhood strikes me as preposterous. In any case, that question and answer conception of thought only applies to matters of fact. Religious and speculative questions are surely on a different level.
We know nothing of religion here. We think only of Christ. We know nothing of speculation. Come and see. I will bring you to eternal fact, the father of all other facthood.
I should object very strongly to describing God as a fact. Great value would surely be a less inadequate description. It is hardly.
Do you not even believe that he exists?
Exists? What does existence mean? You will keep on implying some sort of static, ready-made reality which is, so to speak, there, and to which our minds have simply to conform. These great mysteries cannot be approached in that way. If there were such a thing, there's no need to interrupt, my dear boy. Quite frankly, I should not be interested in it. It would be of no religious significance. God, for me, is something purely spiritual. The spirit of sweetness and light and tolerance and of service, Dick, service. We mustn't forget that, you know.
This is a speech that sounds so much like a college professor conference. Well, anyway, some of my prejudices are showing. If the thirst of the reason is really dead, can you at least still desire happiness?
Happiness, my dear Dick, happiness, as you will come to see when you are older, lies in the path of duty. Which reminds me, bless my soul, I've nearly forgotten. Of course I can't come with you. I have to be back next Friday to read a paper. We have a little theological society down there. Oh yes, there's plenty of intellectual life. Not of a very high quality, perhaps. One notices a certain lack of grip, a certain confusion of mind. That is where I can be of some use today. There are even regrettable jealousies. I don't know why, the temper seems less controlled than they used to be. Still, one mustn't expect too much of human nature. I feel I can do a great work among them. But you've never asked me what my paper is about. I'm taking the text about growing up to the measure of the stature of Christ and working out an idea which I feel sure you'll be interested in. I'm going to point out how people always forget that Jesus was a comparatively young man when he died. He would have outgrown some of his earlier views, you know, if he had lived, as he might have done with a little more tact and patience. I am going to ask my audience to consider what his mature views would have been. A profoundly interesting question. What a different Christianity we might have had if only the founder had reached his full stature. I shall end up by pointing out how this deepens the significance of the crucifixion. One feels for the first time what a disaster it was, what a tragic waste, so much promise cut short. Oh, must you be going? Well, so must I. Goodbye, my dear boy. It has been a great pleasure, most stimulating and provocative. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
The ghost nodded its head and beamed on the spirit with a bright clerical smile, or with the best approach to it which such unsubstantial lips could manage, and then turned away, humming softly to itself, "City of God, how broad and fair." Well, Paul?
Don't pick on me, I'm just the ghost. Just at the moment when you think I'm supposed to say something profound, all I can do is notice the dirt on my glass.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, let me just try to begin some talk about this by saying that I continually meet people, some even here at Holden, who insist that there is no such thing as absolute truth, and for whom the bishop may very well be speaking. And Lewis is saying, I think if he is speaking at least through the bright spirit, that there is such a thing, and that in fact there are sins of intellect, that is to say, errors, which, at least if they are theological errors, need to be repented of, and if they are any kind of error at all, need to be acknowledged and changed. This speech about exist, what does existence mean? You keep on implying some sort of static, ready-made reality, which is, so to speak, there, and to which our minds have simply to conform. That's the kind of speech which I have often heard made at the meetings of the American Academy of Religion, which generally have sort of religion professors in them, and there's almost a kind of horror that one should actually believe something or confess something or be committed to the truth of something. I just wonder how this sits. Go ahead, Gretchen.
Well, I know. For me, I'm in graduate school, and the community around me is certainly very small amount Christian, and there's a great belittling of not only Christians, but anyone who does fix on an idea that something could be absolutely true. It's generally considered a small-minded sort of approach. And I think I can just confess to the difficulty of not being sort of sucked in by that, because these are, you know, your professors and your peers are people that you want to admire you, and it's very difficult. And I can see how the bishop easily wanted respect from the intellectual community, and found that this sort of goal of always inquiring, always searching, and refusing to believe anything to be true would be very attractive. And I think the second thing is that I think people who, we shouldn't always say people who, when we see a truth that we want not to face, the easiest way to do it is to simply say, not that that truth is really wrong, because then we're putting ourselves in a black and white position, but to say that we really can't be sure about anything, and therefore we have to keep searching and make it gray instead, the truth maybe puts us in a humbler position.
So you're
something exists outside of us.
Okay, you're agreeing then with the bright spirit and disagreeing with the bishop.
Certainly, yeah.
Paul for the bishop now.
Well,
I knew I could get an argument going here.
It's been said by wise men, not men like me, that when we meet God face to face, he will be entirely different than anything or anyone than we have ever comprehended. I object to the idea that men can put into words any perfection that they can accomplish, any perfection in words that conveys absolute truth. I object to the idea that there are subtle questions that the men and that the answers men have come up with are inviolably true and should never be reviewed and rethought and rephrased. I think that men are obliged to engage in the constant exercise of rephrasing their thoughts and attempting again and again and again to express them better and better and better, just as you expressed the idea of the Lord's Supper in the outline that I practically purloined from you and then complimented you on it afterward.
Yeah, well, that's the final perfect expression.
I'm sure it is for Water Power on August 3rd, 1979 at 3:19 o'clock, or 4:19 o'clock. I can remember some earlier expressions of the same Walter Bauman that when he expressed them, I'm sure he thought they were the absolute truth. I suspect he said, backed away from me. And now, I'm not going to name any names or anything.
Oh!
But I am firmly of the belief that we should constantly review all our statements, all our confessions, including the Augsburg Confession, and the small called articles, and the Book of Concord, and not
the
insist.
Nicene Creed.
And not the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, as we've done in the LBW. I thought that was a wonderful thing.
But shouldn't there
and
be
not,
some...
And not insist that they are paper popes. I think this is an error. This is a failing. At the same time, I prefer to affiliate with denominations who do have confessions and who respect them as the best ideas of the men of their time. But I don't like the idea of thinking of them as something engraved in granite that should never be reviewed and should be respected beyond the respect they deserve. I guess that's enough. I don't want to take over the whole period.
Well, I just wanted to say, shouldn't there be some limits on, I don't want to say on the scope of the inquiry, because I think I agree with you. I don't want anything in
granted. I don't think there should be any limits on inquiry. Inquiry is a free thing. It should go on forever.
I wish I could put it into words, but I know what Lewis is talking about, this sort of free-floating intellectualism where there is nothing that is any more valid than any other thing. And the feeling that I got from my college experience with that in a different field, in the field of linguistics.
Yeah, they're playing empty intellectual word games.
That there wasn't anything to it. There was no point in it. And
just
I finally
chaff.
Got out of it because mm-hmm. One statement had no more validity, truth, value than any other. And so there was no point in even doing it.
There's
and
no
that's
sincerity,
what
there's
talking
no
about.
Honesty behind some of these empty semantic games, these empty word games. This is what I'm seeing in the bishop. He's just playing with a lot of empty words.
Well.
And I'm again.
It seems that one thing, changing around the words of the creeds and so on, isn't really changing a statement of absolute truth so much as attempting to make it say the same thing today that it said in 358 or whatever year it was.
We, I'm Presbyterian, and we have just attempted to restate our creed.
Mm-hmm.
Our creed was printed in a very small book from Yay by Yay. It is now in a book this thing, this talk, this wide.
We have a copy
in
the library.
And it is precisely the same, the very same words. So if you really, I waded through it. And there is nothing in that that was could not have been included in the very, very small, short creed that he had. Somebody had to put 16,000 words for every one word that he had before.
But that is so invalid. I mean, this is not like the bishop, we can hope anyway, that they did it in good faith, trying to make something clearer.
I think one of the things the bishop, where the bishop goofed up was, now I think there are some absolutes. One, you cannot convince me, my mother died, and I know I've said this to several people, you know, like Christ sinned in any sense. You cannot deny the validity of his death on the cross. It's a, it's an absolute, it's a fact. And I think this is where the bishop got hung up, because he wanted to, he didn't want to cut through, as Vern's so fond of saying, you know, he didn't want to cut through the edge. He wanted to keep it nice and, you know, covered. Because what would he see if he saw him? He had to accept that, and he didn't want to. So he uses any words he can to escape that.
We're in a position of great luxury, as Lewis himself is, in writing this, because he is about to say, he will say, if not at the beginning, I don't recall, but at the end, he'll put this whole thing in a kind of framework of sort of a dream,
mm-hmm.
and let us take or reject what we will with his blessing, sort of, you know. And meanwhile, we look at this bishop character who's a kind of a paper character too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have the luxury of comparing how maybe we would write the book with how Lewis does. it's a little slippery, I think. I think, you know, he's making some points here, but I wouldn't want to be tied to the text, to his text here. Really wouldn't.
You have
I'm not,
not
sure that existence is the way that I want to talk about God.
I wish that bishop were a caricature. I think I have met too many people who sound as if they had written those speeches. It looks like a caricature. I'm afraid it's not. You know, and
C.S. Lewis.
All right.
I had the feeling that he'd been so constantly surrounded by and surfeited with ecclesiastical emptiness that he's striking back at.
Well, the fact that I think yesterday, the character here was modeled after a genuine English bishop. I think Barnes of Birmingham was the person that
you
Lewis
mean a phony English bishop?
No.
Well, he was genuinely phony.
Oh, I mean, he was a live human being. Lewis was not inventing. Lewis was not finally inventing the character, and it wasn't only that Barnes had much of this position, but Lewis is speaking first of all not only for a lot of college people, but I have found, I think. Just in working with college religion classes, sometimes even in working with seminary students, and certainly in working often with American Protestants, the one thing we have great difficulty saying is that somebody is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We have great difficulty saying that. Our way of dealing with the whole question of truth and error has been to start denominations, and then to use the denomination for saying, well, they can believe whatever they want to believe, and we believe whatever we want to believe, and if you're sincere, that's really basically all that counts. Just everyone should be sincere. Now, one of the points Lewis is making is that sincerity is not a criterion for truth. I, at least, always try to put this somehow in extremes. I think that probably one of the most sincere people of our century has been Adolf Hitler. I think he believed exactly what he wrote in Mein Kampf, and got the chance finally to give it powerful political expression and lived it out. Many, many people did not think that Mein Kampf actually represented Hitler's political program. It did. Now, see, there's an example, I think, where one must simply say at least that it was not only a bad but disastrous error, that it was in fact wrong. I don't know how far one would want to push this, but one of the ways in which I always try to get at it is that the position that there is no absolute statement is logically impossible. Just logically, philosophically impossible. Because the statement, there is no absolute, is an absolute.
Jesus was an absolute statement. Completely illogical.
Pardon?
Jesus was an absolute statement. Usually thought of as completely illogical.
By whom?
The people who are offended by the illogicalness of everything that he was and did.
On the contrary, it is not the illogicalness that is the offense.
Go ahead, take it.
I think the offense that Jesus was is that he did in fact call on people to repent, that repentance is the one thing we do not want to do because it would mean that we would have had to have been in the wrong, and so what we prefer to do is to get rid of people who call us to repent. There's nothing illogical. There is nothing illogical about saying that the way to win your enemy is to turn the other cheek. There's nothing illogical about that. It is very logical. It makes eminently good sense. It says that we don't want to put it into practice. We feel a lot better if we can strike out, if we can conquer someone. We are worshipers of force. And we do so, we worship it both when we submit to it and when we inflict it. But that does not mean that that turning the other cheek is illogical.
I guess I was using the term in the sense that it was an offense to our natural instincts. What Jesus teaches seems to always run contrary to our natural instincts. We have to constantly conquer our natural instincts to see it from the viewpoint of the cross. And that was the sense in which I used the word illogical. Excuse me, I interrupted you some more.
That's okay. Now, I've had good examples of it. It's hard for me to believe that I'm actually heard by the Almighty up there because I do not see it. It's not like I can talk to Walt and I can see Walt and I know that he's responding. That is illogical, yet we're called on to do that. Forgiveness.
How is it illogical?
It's illogical. Logic says A plus B, and you know B happened because you can see the results of C. You don't always see the results of it. You don't see it. You can't touch it, you can't feel it, you can't comprehend it. Logic, to me, has to be comprehended.
Am I thinking something right now?
Okay, I can't tell.
Precisely.
But this is my point. If I'm coming from a non-Christian stance, back to what we've been talking about all week, I'm coming from a non-Christian stance. I can't see any logic, quote unquote, in following Christ. What the hell for? Why bother following this guy? They're strung up. There's no logic to it. Why follow a loser? That's what I'm saying. Our faith is illogical.
Yeah. Well, all right. I guess one of the principles that I operate with as a theological thinker is that. That Christianity is indeed quite intelligible, that that one can understand precisely what it is about, and it is only when one understands that the possibility of faith arises, because faith is not the suspension of one's intellect, but a choice among options. In fact, that's the whole kind of thing that Lewis is making here. The case of the big ghost in chapter 4 was a plausible one, and the alternative was equally plausible. The question is, which of them is he going to live by, or die by, as the case may be? I can fall in love with any one of a number of persons in the world. When I asked Jan to marry me, it was because I was willing to entrust myself to that relationship for the rest of my life. Not that there could not have been others for Jan or for me, so that the act of trust is not so much a leap into the unknown, but a choice among the things that are known. It is no more illogical. If there is God, it is no more illogical to think of being heard by him than to think of being heard by me.
Remember what I said, though. I said, from a non-Christian perspective.
All right, and that's what I'm taking issue with. I don't think that being Christian or being non-Christian alters the quality of the argument. It does not alter the quality of the argument. Go ahead, Dave, you wanted to say
something. Well, I'm coming in a little more laterally here, but I guess I guess I want to take the heat off of Bishop's.
Forget it. It looks so normal.
And you put it where it belongs, you see. Because one of the things that I really cannot understand, Walt, and I'm sure you've got some explanations, when I went to the seminary, we had professors that really literally were so angry at one another over, I think, legitimate differences of doctrine that, you know, they did not speak, and you were put into a camp, you were asked to make some commitments. For maybe 25 years now, I've seen a phenomenon in Lutheran theological faculties where when some guy got into trouble because he went in the line, usually the advice was, if you do these things a little more quietly or carefully, you know, that kind of thing doesn't have to happen. In other words, you may be right, but your methodology was wrong. That's usually the nice statement that kind of left me. Now, leaving, you know, the Seminex thing alone, I really, you know, I don't find much passion going on in our seminaries, as if it really made much difference, you know, whether we had truth or error. Am I wrong about that?
Yes. But one of the things that has happened is that the model, Columbus too has its horror stories. I don't know what seminary you were talking about, but let me name one now. Columbus has its horror stories of professors who went for years without speaking to each other on the faculty. And as a reaction to a lot of that, we have cultivated, I think, or some people at least, have cultivated a style of saying the worst thing that can happen to us is that kind of non-collegiality or of faculty hostility to one another. Even worse now, you look at Jacob Preuss, who hunts for heretics and who has unfrocked people in the Missouri Synod for teaching that Moses did not in fact write the Pentateuch and that Isaiah is not a single unified document from the 8th century prophet. We look at Jack Preuss, at that phenomenon, and we say, oh my God, we don't want to be like that. And so then we fall off, in a sense, on the other side, and we say, well, best not to rock the boat. You have your way of explaining something. He has his. I have mine. Let us all sort of just live and let live. But I do think that there are possibilities now for genuine disagreement going on in Lutheran seminaries. To cite some examples, Gritsch and Jensen, Robert Jensen and Eric Gritsch at Gettysburg Seminary have either been suspended or suspended themselves from the presidency of the Eucharist by their synod president because they think that infants ought to be allowed at the Lord's table. Their synod president and James Crumley are certainly supported by at least some theologians in the ALC who helped to draft, and the LCA, who helped to draft the Statement on Communion Practices, and who think that Gritsch and Jensen are in fact wrong. It isn't just saying it's untimely or we need a little more time before infants can be brought to the altar. It's not very timely. It's wrong, these people are saying. So, in fact, I would suspect that Jensen and Gritsch's own dean, Gerhard Krodel, is one of the people who thinks they are flat out wrong and who helped to write the Statement on Communion Practices, which was adopted by ALC and LCA, saying this precludes, this understanding of the Lord's Supper precludes the communion of infants. Trigg Skarsten and I taught the course on the Lutheran Confessions this past winter. He's a church historian, and I'm a systematic theologian. We used the Gritsch and Jensen text. And when we came to that issue in class before our students, Trigg and I disagreed. Trigg has a basically pietist understanding of the Lord's Supper. I do not. I don't know what to call mine. But at any rate, my understanding makes it possible for us to think of infants communing. Trigg's does not, and we disagree. So this happens. It sometimes happens in the same classroom. We have tried, I think, to find ways to disagree and still talk to each other. But that's one issue on which there is disagreement. And it's not going to go away. Again, I think we have tried to find ways at the seminary of responding to the charismatic movement that are probably preferable to the controversy over election, which animated another seminary that shall remain blameless for generations.
Why is it that I think a lot of people, including the one who's supporting the bishop, if anybody is here, can read this Lewis and say, the bishop is wrong? I mean, you know, we can say, yeah, that doesn't feel right, that we can just free-float intellectually through religion. But we can't seem to figure out how to bring that into practice. You know, we're shy about saying somebody's right or somebody's wrong. But in some sense, we seem to feel like somebody should be saying it. How can it be that it seems to be true that there's right and wrong, but that we don't seem to be able to deal with it?
One thing, when you said that you don't like to be put in the position of having to repent, it occurred to me, too, that we're taking the bishop at face value. And it hadn't occurred to me until that point that he's going on and on about free inquiry and all that, but he has absolutely no interest in going along with the bright spirit.
Right.
That's one thing that he doesn't want to inquire into at all, you know.
He wanted to
let me inquire, but I'll inquire where I want to inquire.
Right, right.
He's really a humbug. He's definitely not interested in free inquiry.
I was wondering how you resolve the charismatic movement.
Listen to the tape from yesterday morning. I think it's on the it's 4:45, and I want to give you now the final answer, the ultimate truth, and everything else. I've been just dying to do that all along. Gretchen, I'll hold off for a minute.
I'll let you blunder
along.
No, I'm not going to blunder. I'm just going to recommend that in terms of what Lewis's argument, especially toward what this woman from Tacoma said about logicality, again, recommend Surprise by Joy, and again, Abolition of Man, or even Mere Christianity. He's very good at taking other people's logical arguments apart and reconstructing better ones.
Oh, I wasn't saying that it had to be logical.
But yeah, but you know, if you want to memorize it and rehearse it, then you can give it to someone else who's not a Christian.
I should add, just to jump on top of you a little bit more and stomp.
Pick me up when you
get done. Yes, I will. That I think the whole enterprise of systematic theologians, of which Lewis is one, I mean, he's at least operating in that field, but Paul Tillich would be another. The whole enterprise of systematic theologians is precisely to undercut the notion that if one is a Christian, one is sort of precluded from following a particular argument that only Christians can follow. The enterprise of systematic theology is precisely to say, I want to present a line of argument which any mind that has not suspended its critical functions will be able to follow. Any mind, Christian or non-Christian. And that's the goal of systematic theology, that it does not, as opposed to dogmatic theology. Dogmatic theology really wants to be in-house thinking. We're not arguing the truth of the Christian faith, we're only describing it. That's dogmatic theology. Systematic theology is precisely the attempt to argue it and to demonstrate its validity to any mind that has not lost its rationality.
Okay, I have not lost my rationality. God, you realize that by now.
I do.
But I guess I consider myself right in the point that there's still portions illogic to the Christian faith.
Yeah,
there's still that
seems
portion.
Very new to me too. Is your point about systematic theology and your statement that faith is not a suspension of intellect but a choice among options. For me, faith, I had a hard time defining faith by something that's intellectual, something that's reason. For me, faith is a matter of belief. I can't take and Rich Cameron's Vespers on this messy world, this absurd world, that, you know, leaning on that to come to a matter of faith from a world that in many ways we can't help but perceive it as absurd. Faith to me is simply a matter of faith, a belief in the face of things that in much of I can't understand. I can't simply make a choice to believe or not to believe, a choice to have faith, not to have faith. It's something that is more than simply rational, it's experienced as well. So I have a hard time saying that or understanding how faith can be a choice.
A brief testimony from a person who read Mere Christianity as a non-Christian, and by the time I was through, I was a Christian. I had been looking for faith with this, what does it feel like? I don't know how to do it. I don't want to suspend my critical faculties to become a Christian. How do I do it? I want something. And a friend of mine interviewed Mere Christianity, and logically and rationally, he looked at the absurd world that I was looking at.
But I guess that's
at.
Also an experience, too, reading.
But it was, no!
The point is that there are a number of ways. It is not only Christians who respond to the absurdity of the world. There are a number of ways of responding to the absurdity of the world. Mm-hmm. One is to deny its absurdity. Another way is to affirm the absurdity and to live in spite of it. That's the way of existentialism, Camus, Sartre.
One way is to be overwhelmed by it, which is my way.
Or to just be overwhelmed by it, which is the response of despairing people. And I think Christians offer at least a fourth option in the face of these three, or these other three. Those are all options. They can all be argued. Some can be argued very convincingly, very persuasively. A couple can't. I think despair and existentialist courage can at least be argued convincingly alongside of Christianity. All of which, all three of these options at least, acknowledge the absurdity of the world. Now, the point is, one is not asked to become a Christian groundlessly. The question is, on what grounds does Christianity present itself? And that's specifically the task of systematic theologian, to answer the question, on what grounds do you hold XXX beliefs? Now, what faith adds to this mix of understandings is that the person of faith is the one who invests himself or herself in a particular answer. I'm sure, you introduced me to your fiancé, I'm sure that I could make a valid case for you marrying any one perhaps a half a dozen people. Given your personality type, given the range of people you are likely to meet, I'm sure I could say, rationally, logically, here are six people you could marry. A computer can do that, right? From among those six, you decide to marry one. You have invested yourself in that, right? You could have chosen any one of a number of fields of study and been equally fulfilled and equally able. You invest yourself in one of them, all right? Now, that's the element, so that the element of faith arises at the point where you marry, at the point where you commit yourself to a career, at the point where you adopt an option that has grounds to it. It's not a completely groundless enterprise. If it is, I worry about your sanity. You know, we do not do things groundlessly. Even the mentally ill have grounds for what they are doing. Well, that's the kind of thing I think we're talking about. Please.
I have a question, and that is, if we can find our way to God through a bunch of intellectual arguments, what room does that leave to the Spirit of God? I mean, the whole purpose of Jesus coming to this earth was to give us His Spirit so we could understand
in 1 Corinthians.
In 1 Corinthians. Yeah. Chapter. In 2:14, it says,
yeah.
The unspiritual man does not receive the gift of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. And it seems to me like what you're doing is taking God.
No, precisely not.
I can see the point. I know I've read Mere Christianity too, and I think it's a fantastic book. But still,
it worked for me. Now, you say it wasn't the Holy Spirit.
But that is a faith that is based on something that we do. Mm-hmm. Wow. It was a source of information for me.
This is beautiful because two important things are at work here. The first is that the presence of the Spirit of God is the presence of a particular kind of confession. The confession that Jesus is Lord is not the confession of Paul Sartre or of Albert Camus. And therefore, one can say, they do not have the Spirit of God. Those who confess Jesus as Lord do. But the confession Jesus as Lord is not a groundless confession. That's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. The grounds of that confession are precisely that Jesus of Nazareth happened.
Mm-hmm.
He happened in the world's history and continues to happen as the story of Jesus confronts you and me and all of us. So that when someone says, as Peter does, we must always be ready to give a reason for the hope that is in us, that is precisely what we are doing when we say, I'm not just wishing on a star or following a rainbow. I am following, I am responding to precisely what happened in Jesus as that story continues to be told. So the presence of the Spirit does not mean the suspension of my intellect. It means specific content to my intellectual activity, namely the content that Jesus is Lord. The second point I think that has to be made is that the gift character of that arises precisely at the point where, when I have broken the trust that someone has, I cannot restore that trust by my own activity. I can wish for it. I can understand it. Example, if I have been unfaithful to Jan, and she knows that I have been, I can wish for her to forgive me. I can wish for her to restore the relationship, but I cannot, I am no longer in the position of demanding it as a right or authorizing it. I am no longer in control of our relationship when I have broken it. Only Jan can restore it. If I've embezzled from my bank, and I'm a banker, I can no longer say, you have a right, I have a right to be a clerk in this bank, a cashier. Only the banker can restore it. He is not likely to do so. It's maybe more likely that Jan will. The whole point of the Christian gospel is, only God can trust me once again. And the miracle of the gospel is that he has. Now, that has nothing to do with my understanding of it. You see, I can understand forgiveness even when I am not the object of it. I can tell you exactly what would happen if Jan would trust me once again in our marriage. But I am not in control of it even when I can understand it, you see. I can tell you precisely what pardon is, even though I may have no right to being pardoned. So that what we've got to separate is the gift character and the Spirit character from the possibility of understanding. People can describe the Christian gospel and yet not believe it. Now, what Paul is talking about there is that Jesus' way of being in the world, the way of forgiving, is a way that seems foolish to a person who has built a fortress around himself or herself and who says, there's only one way to function in this world, and that is to do others before they do you. To that kind of a person, and he can make a good case for it. He can say, you are a blasted idiot. You are a fool. If you think that you're going to be successful or powerful or even adequate in a world where you forgive people, where you trust people, where you are open and vulnerable to people, play your cards close to the vest. Make sure nobody can see your hand. Stay in control of your own destiny. To that kind of a person, to Caesar, to all of Caesar's representatives, the gospel is an act of foolishness. In the same way that a friend of mine who drives a Italian sports car, what are they called? A Ferrari, a beautiful Ferrari, who travels to Europe every summer, and he's a faculty member, looks at me and says, Walt, you're an idiot. Why did you ever marry? You know, why don't you be like I am? It's so much a better way to live. Lovers are fools. Look what you got. You know, 3 kids, 8 years of college bills. And he says these things to me. He really does. I have another friend who some years ago just walked out on his wife and kids and said, I don't want to spend the rest of my life doing this. Just walked away. Said, fidelity in marriage is absolutely foolish. Went and moved in with a dean and
of women, and both of them were eventually dismissed from the school. That's the kind of foolishness, you see, that Paul is talking about when he says the gospel looks foolish to people who don't believe it. Have I made some sense
at all? Everything that you said, I think, I agree with you, and I agree that you have to have ground to get the beans on, and that you can't say, well, I have the Spirit of God, and I don't have to understand what I believe. I don't think that's true at all.
Mm-hmm.
I wholeheartedly agree with you there, but I think there's something missing. I had just a minute ago.
Take your time.
Yeah, it has to do with sort of Paul wrote that in the context of, say, forgiveness, or say things like that. But, and it looks great. It looks great on paper. It looks great in words and what you just said. But when you're out working with people, and you are dealing with powers, when you are dealing with the power of God on one hand and the power of Satan on the other, you are running into people whose minds are not just blocked and understand all sorts of things like forgiveness, like, you know, the ideas and stuff of the gospel. But there is a total block when it comes to having God as that absolute behind that. And it just seems like
What you're saying is there's a difference between understanding and trusting. They are not the same mood. That's what you're saying. And
no,
I agree with that.
That's not really what I'm saying, though.
Oh.
I'm saying is that maybe you think you understand, but you don't really.
Yeah, I think, pardon me for trying many times, I like it to what you're saying is, you can get right up to the point that you know the history of Jesus, you know what Christians believe, you know that your best friend is a Christian, you know all kinds of stuff, but the actual mechanism that turns you into one is the Holy Spirit. I think that's maybe what you're trying to say, is that kind of the idea?
Mm-hmm.
And what she's suggesting to about systematic theology is that she thinks you're saying, well, if we just explain it to them.
No.
No,
that's not what I'm saying.
No.
In fact, the moves that Lewis makes are precisely not those moves at all. In Mere Christianity, what Lewis does is to demonstrate with an argument that that our experience leads us to an encounter with God, and he closes that part of his argument by saying the encountering is terrifying beyond words,
mm-hmm.
and that people who pursue the encounter with God in terms of this world and its capacity to mediate God to us end up scared witless. That's and the end, right there. He says, any other ending is just soft soap. Now, that is not an argument into the Christian proclamation. He breaks off at that point and he says, now I'm going to start over. Now I'm going to tell you what the Christian proclamation is. And at that point, you are really confronted with the alternative. In the last analysis, there is no explanation for why one believes. But the Spirit is present where one believes. I'm not trying to give people an explanation as to why one believes. In the last analysis, if you ask Stephen, why is he engaged to Mary? He will be able to give you ground, right? But he will not finally be able to answer the question, well then, you know, why Mary? Even granted that there are these grounds, why Mary? There is no answer for that. In the same way, there is no answer as to why a person becomes a Christian. But there are ways of telling when do we have the Spirit and when do we not.
Paul?
It's after 5, and I'm going to give you the last
word.
Well,
we don't eat until 5:15 anyway.
I can't go on until
5:15. I feel what Buck Devin is asking for, and what he's proposing for, is spontaneity for the leap of faith, for passion, for this spark, this leap, which he's partly described in his last conversation with him over here. Not satisfied to have it as reasoning your way. There has to be this leap, this spontaneity, this passion, this moment.
Lewis never says that he argues himself into being a Christian. He does say he argues himself out of every other alternative. Well, the point I'm trying to make, I guess I'm trying to safeguard a fairly narrow, fairly small dimension to the enterprise. I'm trying to safeguard a couple of things. First of all, that Christian faith is not groundless faith, that it has ground. I want to safeguard that. I think that the task of systematic theology, I've compared it sometimes to the difference between a cookbook and eating. You can't eat the cookbook, so you can't eat the whole intellectual process. But cookbooks make it possible for us to have food on the table. They're not the same thing as food. Or another analogy would be a book on sex is not the same thing as being married, all right? But there is a place for it. And I think that's the kind of thing I'm trying to argue for. You can't just say to people, I feel you're wrong. I think it's incumbent upon us, among other things as Christians, to be able to demonstrate the invalidity, the error. I also think it's incumbent upon us to try to demonstrate the truthfulness of what it is that we believe. But that's not a way that people become Christians. It's only a way of explaining what the dynamic of Christianity is in such a way that it can be understood. And I wanted to add one last point. I think that the criterion of the truthfulness of the Christian gospel as opposed to error is that when one has the truth, one does not persecute error. It is a contradiction of the truth of the gospel that in its name one persecutes. That is a sure sign that one does not have the very truth of the gospel in the name of which one is persecuting error. So that the hallmark of the truth of the gospel is that one is free in believing it to suffer rather than to be the inflictor of suffering. One is free to be a victim rather than to make victims. That is the hallmark of the truth of the gospel. But that does not mean there is no truth. There is truth, and its quality is that one is free to suffer. I think that's the way I want to say no to David.